Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. For today's episode, I'm really pleased to be joined by Ros Doherty, who I came across through a mutual friend. And she seemed to me to be an absolutely prime example of somebody who's rebuilt a life after a big loss. So I thought it would be useful to talk to you, Ros, about your experience. I know you're currently vice chair of the Cransley Hospice Trust, as well as very many other strings you've got to your bow. But would you like to begin by taking us back to when your husband died and when this all began for you?
Well, my husband, who was just 70, Vince, his name was Vince, was unwell, but nothing serious. And he had just had a diagnosis of a hiatus hernia, which we knew was manageable, could be controlled. And once he'd got that diagnosis, he felt much better than he had done for the previous few months. We went away to a health farm for a couple of days and had a lovely couple of days where we were able to put, I think, some of the tension and the stress of the previous few months behind us. And all my memories of that few days were just laughing, telling stories about my mother in particular. We came home and had an quiet evening at home. And in fact, we spent the evening planning our next holiday. And we decided that we'd go back to Italy, a place we'd been to a number of times previously, and really were looking forward to where we were going to go and going to see different parts of the country. At that time, we were sleeping in separate rooms because he was adjusting to having to sleep sitting upright because of the hiatus hernia. So I was in the spare room and he was in our bedroom. And went to bed, everything was absolutely fine. Woke up at about 6:15 and I heard banging from our bedroom. So I got up, went into the bedroom, and he was in the process of trying to get out of bed, but couldn't do so. So he said, "I can't move, I can't get out of bed." I immediately thought he'd had a stroke. So I phoned the ambulance, and within 6 or 7 minutes, a paramedic had arrived, and then the full ambulance team came very quickly after that. And I think they realised straight away that it was catastrophic, because they said to me, "You need to come in the ambulance with us, don't bring your car, and you will have a very difficult day ahead of you," which was what the actual paramedic said to me. We went off in the ambulance, and once we got to the hospital, once they'd done a CT scan, they explained to me that he'd had a massive bleed, he'd had a cerebral hemorrhage, and that all the signs were that there was a shift in the midline of his brain, which is catastrophic and terminal, and that he would die during the course of that day. So very quickly, it was very clear that there were no other options but immediate palliative care. The hospital were wonderful. They put us in a room, a private room at the back of a ward where we had privacy and we were able to come and go as we wished. And I was able to call his family and my children who came to support us as well. And he died later that day. So having gone up at about 6:00, he had died before midnight. And it was a huge shock, as you can imagine. And I think in lots of ways, because it all happened so quickly, we didn't really have time to take on board the significance of what had happened, because you're just dealing with the practicalities of making sure the family are contacted, making sure that close friends are made aware of what's happening. And there was no decision to be taken. I thought at one stage I would have to make a decision about whether they were going to terminate treatment or not, but there was no decision to be taken because his death played out following on from the brain hemorrhage, and there was no intervention. He and I had talked about death and dying and what we wanted previously, so I knew that he didn't want to be kept alive unnecessarily, but by the same token, he wanted every chance to survive. And I said I wanted him to be kept comfortable and as dignified as possible. That was the most important thing. And they were able to do that. And then during the course of the evening, it was obvious that he was deteriorating and he died later that evening. And that was really how we had to face it. You know, it all happened very quickly. And as I said, I then went straight into task mode. I felt very overwhelmed by what I perceived as all the things I would have to sort out. In the immediate death, there was a period of the funeral, and then there were all the things about probate, the administration. And in fact, that was my focus initially. I went straight into task mode. I went straight into doing jobs. And I think that saw me through probably for the first 10 weeks, 9 or 10 weeks. And I didn't give myself chance to stop. I just went from one job to another. Every day I had a job and I just went from one job to another. And I would say that it is only in retrospect that I can get some perspective of how I behaved at that time. At the time, it just felt like I was doing something every day, right? Today I'm going to do this, tomorrow I'm going to do that, the next day I'm going to see the bank, the next day I'm going to see the solicitors, and so on. I was very, very well supported. I have a wonderful family and group of friends who supported me throughout this, and I never had to do anything on my own. I always had somebody alongside me. But I was the one who was pushing through all the time. I was the one who was saying, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to do that. And looking back now, I realize I didn't give myself time to stop. And I didn't really allow myself to think about what had happened and the consequences of what had happened. I focused on the jobs and I focused on what needed to be done. And I did far too much. I had been told previously, I come from a large Irish family and the Irish talk about death quite a lot, but I had been told previously by one of my cousins who was a widow that you accept every invitation you're given, but you make sure you have a get out clause. So if you go places, you take your own car, so that if it all gets too much, you can go home. You're not dependent on other people. So I took up every invitation I was offered. I took too many holidays. I took too many outings. I took too many visits. And I also did lots of changing in the house, which again, I think is not unusual. Lots of decorating, changing our bedroom, selling it, moving off his clothes to a charity shop. And really, it was only much later on in the year, probably about 9 months on, that I was in a position where I had to stop. And it was only then I really started to deal with what had happened.
So what were the feelings? What was it that made you realise you needed to stop? What kind of feelings overtook you?
Well, I think the first thing was I went on a holiday. I went on a singles holiday to Sicily, which I really didn't enjoy, and I was quite unwell on that holiday. And I think that was the first time I realized that my modus operandi wasn't working. Up till then, it had worked. And then when I came back from that holiday, I had trivial things, very minor things. I had a problem with my central heating, which is a very trivial thing. But I went 2 or 3 days without heat in the house, and everything seemed to overwhelm me. And I suddenly had this period where I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I felt nauseous all the time, and I felt generally unwell, and a sense of not being in control, which was something I'd probably hung on to very much through the earlier stages of my bereavement. I'm probably a control freak by nature anyway, and I think I had tried to do, by doing things, I had tried to retain control. I've seen it in other people subsequently. I've seen other bereaved people following a similar pattern where you get on and you do stuff and you keep doing stuff. And it's, for me, it was about, by keep doing things, I don't have to sit with my grief or sit with what has happened. And not just what has happened, but the consequences going forward of what has happened. Because a bereavement of your partner is life-changing. There's no other way to describe it. And you have to, for me, I had to come to terms with that. So having had this period where I was feeling unwell, I went to see my GP and I explained that I was feeling unwell, I wasn't sleeping, I was nauseous, and everything felt a huge effort. And she arranged for me to make contact with the local Mind charity. And I had an assessment. And I then had about 6 weeks counselling with a very, very, I would say it was quite light touch therapy, really. We really just explored the bereavement, what had happened, how I was dealing with it. And she gave me some techniques of how to cope. And there was some of the things she said was, do things for other people, learning, activities that you enjoy, so that there was a little group of things that I could put in place that she said the research indicated was quite helpful. And with her, I was able to explore my feelings and explore my bereavement and my sense of bereavement in a way that I hadn't done previously and hadn't allowed myself to do previously. And that really was very helpful. She was a very nice woman. She was younger than me, but we were able to relate in quite a way. And we laughed quite a lot. It wasn't heavy. It didn't go into my childhood or my relationship with my mother or any of the things that a lot of psychotherapy might cover. It was really just focused on tools to help me accept the bereavement. I think that was it more than anything else.
Did you feel she was kind of giving you permission to grieve after all that time?
I think I was the person who had to give me permission to grieve. I was the person who hadn't given myself permission to grieve. I was the person who was saying, you've got to be strong, you've got to get on, you've got to focus, you've got to get this done. I was not saying I could grieve. She was very, she was just exploring options, I think, with me, more than saying, or directing me to find solutions. She was just exploring options with me. And through that process, and as I said, it was 6 weeks, it was quite a light touch, it wasn't heavy. I realised that I had to give myself permission to grieve. And I think I was able to do that because she and I had talked about it, and she had allowed me to show my vulnerability in a way that I hadn't done with my family and friends. And it's quite interesting, really, because I'm sure you must have found this. When you have a bereavement, if you present a stiff upper lip and get on with things, everybody says, you're doing very well. the implication being that if you don't do that, you're not doing well. So the message from the society within which we live, I think, is that doing well is presenting a stiff upper lip and getting on with things and being strong and being brave and pretending everything's okay. That is, you're doing very well, rather than saying, actually, you're doing well because you're allowing yourself to show your vulnerability, and you're doing well because you're allowing yourself time and space to grieve for the person, the past, and the future. You have to grieve for what you had planned ahead as well as what you've lost in the past.
It's really interesting, isn't it? I've discussed this before on different podcasts. We seem to, in general, society doesn't want to acknowledge how bad grief and loss is. So it prefers to skirt around it. And that's why it wants us to present this okay face. And if we do show the vulnerability, then it's a bit scary for us because we don't know the reaction of other people, do we? And I certainly found, and I still do find, that I'm more comfortable being vulnerable with people who've suffered a similar loss to myself, mm-hmm. because I know they'll understand.
And I think also, people don't know what to say. My father died when I was 15, and I think that has informed a lot of my thinking about bereavement and grief. And I can remember going back to school the first day after Daddy died. He died quite suddenly. And I walked into the classroom and there was silence because people don't know what to say. And one girl just said, "Hello, Ros." And it was okay then. Now that's, what, 60 years ago? But those things haven't changed. When you're showing your pain and your loneliness and your sadness and your anger as well, because there's a lot of anger associated with it, people just don't know what to say. And what I think from my own experience is that it doesn't matter what you say, because you won't change how the person feels. What matters is that you recognize and acknowledge the fact that they're going through those difficult times and those difficult emotions. And the worst thing is to say nothing, and the worst thing is to ignore somebody, or to try, as you say, try and skirt around it, or put the bereaved person in a position where they feel they've got to skirt around it. And how often do people say to you in those early days, how are you doing? And you say, I'm fine. And that's what they want to hear, because they don't want you to say, well, actually, I'm having a really tough time at the minute for various reasons.
I remember somebody very close to me, I won't name the person, saying, but you are okay, aren't you? Now, how do you answer that? It sounded as if she needed me to be okay for her.
And I'm sure that's exactly the reality of it. She wants you to say, yes, I am okay, because she wouldn't want to deal with the reality of you not being okay. But that's part of the culture in which we live, I think.
So we have to then try and be okay for those around us, don't
yes.
we?
Yes. And that is exhausting.
Mm.
I think that thinking back, you put so much energy into pretending to be okay for people and pretending to be fine and holding yourself in check emotionally, that takes up so much energy. That takes a lot of energy, and it's very, very tiring.
So you've given us some good advice there of how people should perhaps be handling it rather than skirting around it, like I said. Would you like to carry on with your story about how you then got yourself into a position where you felt able to face the future?
Well, I was very lucky because I did have a sort of complete break within a year. So the first year, I think, was going through all those firsts, dealing with all the difficulties and new experiences of being bereaved. And I was invited to go to South Africa with a friend of mine whose brother lived in South Africa. And she wanted to go and visit her brother, and I'd never been to South Africa. So we went together, and that was on the anniversary. We actually travelled on the anniversary of Vince's funeral, not the day he died, but 3 weeks later, the funeral. And that was just coincidental. But for me, that felt like a complete break. I had a lovely holiday. I stayed with my friend and her family. And we were all people who'd grown up together. So my friend and her brother and his wife and I had all gone to school together. Our dads all worked at the same company. We had lots of shared history. And they were the most wonderful hosts. They made us feel very, very welcome. And I had a lovely, lovely 3 week holiday in South Africa. And I can remember coming back from Robben Island. We visited Robben Island on the boat. And on the way back, I was standing at the side of the boat looking out and coming back from the island. And of course, you're very aware of the whole of the Mandela story and what he'd experienced. And I can remember thinking to myself, right, well, if this is my life from now on, I can handle this. And that was the first time I felt that. I can do this. I hadn't felt up till then that I was going to be able to do life going forward. But on that boat coming back, I can remember thinking, yes, I'll be all right. I can do this. I can get pleasure in things again. I can enjoy things again. And a realization that I had a good group of friends and family that was supporting me. And then when I came back, I suppose I then sort of did a pivot, if you like. And the first year was all about experiencing everything for the first time. And then having had that 3 weeks and that little realization on the boat that I was going to be able to cope with this, how am I going to do it going forward? And I carried some of the things that had been discussed in the counselling sessions with me about learning, about helping other people, and about making a new life for myself in a different context. So I was the same person, but the context within which I was now living was different to how I had lived previously and how I'd anticipated living. So I had to make those changes. So I was in the process of studying anyway. I had been doing my PhD before my husband died, and I'd taken some time off to deal with all the admin things. So I went back to do that, and I completed that. I was about halfway through when my husband died, I suppose. So I completed that about 3 years later. And that gave me a really major focus. So I was learning something new. It was mentally demanding. It gave me something to do every day. It gave me structure. I never had a day, even through lockdown, when I didn't have anything to do because there was always something I needed to do. And there was a sense of achievement as well with that. And that was a big thing. I was quite involved in my children's lives, but I had always been, that wasn't new. And I wanted to get involved in some charity work. I had started that process before my husband died, and I'd actually contacted the hospice a couple of months before he died, and we were in the process of exploring what I could do there. But when he died, I felt, and they felt as well, that working in end-of-life or palliative care was probably not the best place for me at that stage. And generally, the hospice now, we would encourage people to take 6 months from a bereavement before they actually actively get involved. Because I think very raw, and you're dealing with end-of-life issues all the time, and you need to have a little bit of distance from your own experience before you can deal with it dispassionately or professionally. So I then recontacted them, and I was asked if I would be interested in going as a trustee. So I did that at the end of lockdown. And that's been, again, something I've really gained a lot from and I really enjoy. I've learned a lot about myself working as a volunteer, actually. It's quite interesting because I'd always thought I'd worked for financial gain, success, achievement, promotion, all those things. But I've learned that I don't, even without those things, I still have that same work ethic that I had in my professional life. And it's rewarding, it's been encouraging, it's been supportive. There's a great sense of camaraderie working with a group of other people, which I missed being at home on my own. And I really enjoy it and I really get a lot out of it.
Can you describe what it is you actually do?
Right, well, I do two things, really. I'm the vice chair of the board. The trust is not directly responsible for running the hospice. The hospice is run through the NHS. And we provide funds to provide enhanced services and influence service delivery at the hospice. So we are responsible for fundraising predominantly. As well as that, I've taken on the role of coordinating all the volunteers at the hospice. We're a relatively small outfit, but we have about 130 volunteers, some of whom are more involved than others. And I'm their first point of contact and trying to put personnel structures in place for volunteers who don't have the protection of employment legislation. So it's like an HR role and it's like a board, non-executive board director role. So I fulfill the two roles within the hospice. And that means I have quite a lot of time. I spend three mornings a week there and then other meetings and the board meetings as well.
People have asked me if doing these podcasts is bad for me in the sense that it's putting me in touch with death and dying frequently. And my answer has always been, no, I don't think so. I'm enjoying meeting people and hearing their stories, and it's a natural curiosity in me that I've always had. So it's kind of an extension of the rest of my life. But I have to confess that it did take me about 18 months before I felt comfortable going back into the hospice where Michael died. But now I am very comfortable and I go there often. But I think people worry on our behalf that maybe we're doing something that's pushing us too close to death and dying when we've suffered a loss ourselves.
Well, I have a view that death is part of life. I think in the culture we've lived in and live in, historically, people don't talk about death very much and they don't accept it or try and airbrush it. Now, as I said before, I'm Irish. I come from an Irish, large Irish family. And I think the Irish have a slightly different attitude to death. My grandmothers probably all lost babies at various stages of their early lives. So death was a reality in their lives in a way perhaps I didn't experience or my mother didn't experience. And I think it's important to recognize that it is a part of life. We're all going to die. That is one reality. And I think it is important to face up to that. I also think it's quite helpful as we get older to be able to have conversations about what we want in terms of our own death and what we want in terms of our care at the end of life. I always talk about dying. I don't talk about passing. And I talk about a funeral, not other forms of celebration. I've talked to my children about what I want. If I die, I've made plans for my funeral. I've made plans for end of life. And I view this debate on assisted dying with very mixed emotions. Because I really think if we had good palliative care available to everybody, a lot less people would feel the need to go down the assisted dying path. And I would hope that the more we can talk about good palliative care and how it can be provided, and it's costly, there's no two ways about it, the cost of it, but the reality of what it means, we would be in a position to provide that for more people, and they could have a peaceful, dignified, gentle end of life, rather than this dreadful process of having to go abroad for assisted dying and all the things associated with that.
You did say earlier that you and your husband had discussed death. I would have thought you're quite an unusual couple, and maybe that's because of your Irish background. Was that helpful in the end, or was that all out?
Yes, I think it was. I think it was. What happened was my son-in-law's mother died very suddenly. So we, within the family, we had experience of somebody who hadn't been ill, and she ended up with a pain and she died that day. And it made us all stop and think. And I did say to my husband, what would you want? And it's partly that, but it's partly the Irish thing as well, I think. So I did know what he wanted. I knew he wanted to be cremated. So that made organising his funeral and the circumstances associated with that easier, really, because I was clear what he wanted to happen. And I was able to say, well, no, Vince and I have talked about this, and this is what he would like to happen. And that was accepted. There were no major challenges to that. I've also had that conversation with my children. I have now made out what I want in terms of my funeral. I've even picked the music and the readings. I mean, that's the control freakery, of course. I understand that. But I've done that with all my children. And it's all written down. It's in one of my boxes about end-of-life issues. I've done all the sort of legal things. I've set up power of attorney for both health and finance so that we're not having to do that. I've done a DNR, and I've also made a living will. So I'm very clear, and as clear as I can be, what would happen at the end of my life. So my family know what my wishes are, and while they laugh about it, I know that when the time comes, they'll be able to fulfill that. That will make life easier for them as well, I think, because it will help them to make decisions without having to argue about it or justify it to other people.
So to conclude, Ros, could you sum up for me basic things that you think you've learned in the last, 7 years now, isn't it?
7 years, yeah, exactly 7 years. I think I would say give yourself time to grieve. Slow down. There will come a point when you have to sit with it. You have to sit with the grief at some stage and allow that. Take all the support that's available to you. It's available for a very short period of time. There will be somebody else with a more tragic story coming along next week. So while that power is available and that help is available, take it. And be gentle with yourself. Don't expect too much of yourself. And I think also, which is a very sort of common and may sound trite, but there is no right way to do grief. There is no right. If I feel X, then that's the right thing for me. If you feel Y, then that's the right thing for you. And it's not about comparison, or it's not about I've recovered more quickly than you have, or you've recovered more quickly than I have. It's an individual thing. And you have to listen to yourself and give yourself the time and the space and permission to sit with it. And however long that takes, accept that.
Very wise words. Thank you, Ros Doherty, so much for talking to me.
You're very welcome.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.